Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRue Show. It's Saturday, November 22nd, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. When Libyan leader Gaddafi was murdered on October 20th, 2011, after months of warfare conducted against his country by NATO forces with the United States in the lead, Lyndon LaRouche said that Syria would be next. But the real target of the British Empire behind these bloody regime change policies is Russia. This is something that LaRouche had presented previously in his 1999 broadcast, Storm Over Asia, where he identified the extension of the Bernard Lewis plan for destroying not only the Middle East, but of going up into Russia and destroying any sovereign nation states in Eurasia. And going back to the October 20th statement, or the murder of Gaddafi, LaRouche's statement then was that if President Obama were not stopped, quote, "we are looking at the immediate disintegration of civilization," unquote. 2 months before that, in August 2011, Obama already had called for the removal of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Obama at that time said, "The future of Syria must be determined by its people, but President Assad is standing in their way. For the sake of the Syrian people, the time has come for Assad to step aside," unquote. Now the irony here is that when elections were actually held in Syria, even as the civil war funded by Obama's allies of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others was gaining strength, Assad won re-election by an overwhelming majority. In other words, the Syrian people did vote. They did determine their future in a democratic election, and they voted for Assad. But Obama ignored that, pushing ahead with regime change to the present day, where he is now more forcefully calling for the removal of President Assad. Most Americans oppose an expanded U.S. involvement of boots on the ground, in spite of what we've seen in the recent period. The so-called civil war has continued, driven not by Syrian fighters, but by foreign fighters, backed by Saudi money and arms and logistical support from Turkey and the United States. To the extent that the regime has had a weakening of its hold over the whole country as a result of the civil war, we've seen the emergence of the Al-Qaeda affiliate Al-Nusra, and the so-called Islamic State, which is being deployed not just against Syria, but against Iraq, Lebanon, and Jordan. The barbarism of ISIS, with the beheadings and the slaughter of Christians and the destruction of ancient monuments, has opened the door for Obama to expand the U.S. presence in the region, as the American people are somewhat shocked by this. But as in Libya, the president is acting in violation of the Constitution and in violation of the War Powers Act, engaging in warfare without the consent of Congress. At the same time, in the United States, we hear little about the actual situation in Syria, except for the rantings of the regime change crowd, who speak of the dictator Assad, the heroic resistance against him of democratic forces, and that he's being propped up by Russia's President Putin. Even with all this propaganda, when Obama insisted last summer, or actually it was the summer of 2013, of attacking Syria because of the supposed crossing of his red line with chemical weapons, even though we now know clearly it was the rebels supported by Obama who used chemical weapons, the American people mobilized to stop the United States from bombing Syria, and President Putin intervened with a very effective deployment to convince Obama not only not to bomb, but to move to get rid of the chemical weapons. In spite of all this, the Obama administration is persisting, and just recently he again demanded that Assad must go while pushing for increased funding, minimally $500 million, to arm the virtually non-existent moderate Syrian opposition. In the midst of this regime change operation, there's a question which is not taken up by the media, nor by war-driven politicians like Senator John McCain, who are demanding robust U.S. involvement. That question is, what is actually going on inside Syria. On this program today, to answer this question, I will be joined by Ulf Sandmark, who's just returned from a mission to Syria. Ulf is a longtime leader of the LaRouche movement in Sweden, and he spent 5 days in Syria as part of a delegation of the Syrian Support Committee for Democracy. He's written a fascinating report on his visit, which will be published in the next issue of the Executive Intelligence Review. Ulf, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Harley. Thank you.
Let's begin with what you saw in Syria. What was the situation in Damascus, in the capital, and in the area from Beirut to Damascus, which you saw in the drive-in?
Well, it was quite astonishing to see a fully functioning country and the city full of cars and people walking in the streets and high buildings and quite a normal city. When we came from Lebanon by car, we had quite a bad road going to the border. Right after the border in Syria, there was a four-lane highway, a paved highway with lampposts all the way, and there were big towers of power transmission along the road. So you could really see this is a country that is in order and is organized and has a policy of development since before the war.
So what you saw then, as you said in your report, is that there was a kind of, there was an effort by the population to maintain a business as usual of continuing normal life in spite of the civil war.
Yeah, it's a kind of warfare that's going on by organizing your normal activity, conducting the functions in society as a part of keeping the country functioning. So there was no hysteria, no aggressiveness, but the people were calm and determined and in confidence that the nation would prevail.
And in Damascus itself, at one point there had been attacks from the rebels. Is Damascus relatively outside of the battlefront, or are there parts in the suburbs that are still under attack?
There are suburbs still controlled by the terrorists and rebels, and these areas are war zones. But the center of Damascus had been attacked partly by grenades being shot right into the old town and to the different hitting monuments, but also terrorist attacks against targeted ministries and things like that. But this has been repaired, and they are trying to keep the country looking normal and back to normal as much as possible as a part of the war effort. They had a big, big fountain with the tents of fountain pouring water right in the Umayyad Square, right in the center, and it was pouring there every time we passed it. So this is a show of the power and the normality that is in the city.
And did you get a sense from, I guess you had a chance to talk with some shopkeepers and others. Just tell us a little bit about what the mood is. I mean, you say that people are determined, they want to continue to keep the country independent. There must also be some anger toward the West with the support of the rebels.
Well, they were absolutely angry, but they didn't show that. When I was asking them, what about your situation? What do you need? Well, the baker said, I have all the ingredients I need. He also said, what do you want for the future? Well, it's good now, he said. So this kind of statements I got from many, many people, and also a shop owner, an Armenian, stopped me because we were the only European-looking people in the streets, and he said, you must tell people that this how it looks like, what you see, because he said, this is not, it has to come out, that people are living there a normal life, they are working, they are busy, and they are determined to make it function. The shops were full of food. There was fish, there was vegetables, there was meat in the shops, there was also candies, big candy stands. There was also this famous baklavas in big piles, these pastries they have. And then we could also see all kinds of normal shops around there. So what we have is a situation where they have a supply of the food, and actually the food is still exported from the country. And even we heard that even gasoline was smuggled out of the country because it's more expensive in Jordan than it is in Syria.
Now, there were elections held, I don't remember exactly when, but I believe that Assad got something over 80% of the vote. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it was 2012, and I think that's about accurate. I don't have the numbers, actually. But he was elected, and it was an election of the presidency. And there were a few candidates also in opposition, but they didn't get much of the votes. So the country is very much rallying behind him because what goes on is that he is the protector, you can say, of all the minorities, especially Christians and others. They are leaning on him because he's from a minority, but also the country is very, very ecumenical. I mean, they are really have a lot of religions, lot of languages. They normally say about Syria, you speak 8 languages on the street, every street of Syria. So this is a country very much ecumenical and working together between the religions.
Well, I think that's something that's quite important, that it's a country that actually functioned as a secular republic that was a home to many religions, many ethnic groups, not so different from Iraq, although you did have periodic uprisings, particularly from the Sunni side of things, but most of these were funded from outside. One of the things that you wrote about is that you talked to some people who were in the government who were women, and I believe it's the case that in Syria, as in Iraq, women play a very vital role in the institutions, education, government. Is that something that you could see when you were there?
Yeah, absolutely. The women were very proud and very, very open and open into the discussions. Also among the population, there was a kind of egalitarian situation. Normal people were speaking to the higher people, shopkeepers, I mean, waiters and others. They were speaking to the customers like they were friends or relatives, and probably many of them were actually relatives. So they were joking all the time among high and low, and also the women were part of this discussion.
And did you find from the people you met with, and I know we can get into this in a moment, you did meet with some people from the government who presented some very interesting reports to you, but did you find that they have a sense of why Syria was targeted, that they understand this idea of regime change as something conducted on behalf of the empire, the British Empire, but the U.S. in the lead of this, and that ultimately it's not just Syria that's targeted, but any sovereign nation state? Do they have some sense of that?
Well, normal people, they just couldn't understand what was going on, because these terrorists and the rebels, they are destroying hospitals, they're destroying schools, they're destroying grain silos. So they are destroying exactly the infrastructure that is supposed to function if they would take over the country. They have demontaged 2,500 industries. Some of them are destroyed, but also dismantled to be brought over the border into Turkey. So they are actually basically destroying the country, and they could not understand how the West could support such things, and even more the killing of people, but also the monuments. These monuments are 7,000 years old. The cities, they are of the 10 cities oldest in the world, 4 of them are in Syria. Damascus is something like 8,000 years old, and Aleppo is even 12,000 years old. So these cities are historical monuments for the world that are preserved like a heritage for civilization. And they can't just understand how someone, especially from the West, supposed to be coming with enlightenment from the West, is supporting this destruction. And it's a deliberate destruction to destroy the culture of the country.
Ulf, we hear a lot now about ISIS, but in this rebellion or the opposition to Assad, at what point did the foreign fighters start coming in?
Well, what happened was there was these demonstrations, and then after 1.5 months, they started to pull out weapons. But there was all the time the speaking of friendly terror or non-armed demonstrators, so or friendly demonstrators. So this is not true, because what was going on, it's also in a UN report that there was shootings from the top of the from the top of the houses by snipers shooting on both sides. So the UN report spoke about the third force, and this was to instigate that the army being shot at was starting to shoot at the demonstrators, and then
it's just
then,
like Ukraine,
they armed themselves.
It's just like Ukraine and the Maidan.
Yeah, exactly. And there was parents coming to bring the son to the hospital. He was dead, and they found out that he was shot in the back from people who was behind him in the demonstration. So in this way, people understand that this is very much a provoked thing that is going on. And now the warfare is totally a warfare underground. I mean, the warfare now, they told about the warfare that they had caught a terrorist, the army, and this guy had not seen the sky for 6 months. He was living in the tunnels. They have tunnel boring machines like you have for boring tunnels for big infrastructure projects. So these kind of specialized machines are working themselves underground, 50 meters underground, and these are big tunnels, normally for three people going on the side. They could even have trucks in the tunnels. So this is the type of warfare that was done by Hezbollah in southern Lebanon and by Hamas in Gaza. And the Israelis had to go into Gaza, into the tunnels, to have the fight, and was very severe, because these terrorists have adapted to the warfare of the Syrian Air Force has a superiority, so they have gone underground. So when America comes now with Air Force, it doesn't add anything, because the terrorists since years are underground.
And what we're hearing is that they're basically bombing American military equipment that was provided to the so-called moderate Syrians, which have been taken over by the radicals and jihadists. So, Ulf, also, was there an al-Qaeda force inside Syria before the civil war? Because we're reading now about reports on the ineffectiveness of the overall U.S. strategy and the so-called Obama plan for degrading ISIS. And what it says is that we're actually creating more terrorists by what we're doing. So has that been the case, that the growth of the terrorists has been directly related to what the U.S. is doing in the region and the attacks on Assad?
Yeah, the terrorists have been recruited from all over the world to go there. And as was reported the other week, that CIA has been training up to now 400 people a month to go into Syria. But this it would expand it to 1,000 for this so-called moderates. But so this has been going on. Thousands of people have been trained along in Jordania, Turkey, by military from the West to go into Syria. So they have been pouring in from the whole world, terrorists. And this is something that has been going on for 4 years. So this is support of the ISIS has been going on for 4 years. And only now the West is saying we are against ISIS.
And when you met with some officials in the government, you said they presented you with a book with photos and backgrounds of the terrorists. What was in there, and what had they compiled?
Well, this was a book more than 1.5 foot high, and this pile of books was one book. It was one page for each terrorist with a picture and details about his background, what they could have found out, a name and so on. And then these books were organized in different for different countries from where the terrorists came from. So the Saudi books was the biggest, and the book about the Tunisian was the second biggest. But there was also a book from with all the European nation flags on, and also American, Canadian, Australian flags, where they had a thick book with terrorists coming from these countries. So this is actually a whole network of terrorists that has been offered to the world, to the United Nations, to the America, but they didn't receive the books. They refused them. But actually, if you pursue these information in those books, you can find out the whole ISIS network all over the world, the whole terrorist global terrorist network. And this is refused. So this war against ISIS is quite, just like the Syrians say, it's a fake war, as long as you don't work with Syria, who has all the details about these terrorists.
Well, it would seem that these European governments in particular, the British government and also the U.S., that are worried about foreign fighters coming back after having been trained and battle-hardened in Syria, that if they really wanted to protect themselves from that, they would work with the Syrian government.
Yes, but they don't do that. And in reality, we have Syrian youth, we have immigrant youth in Sweden who go now to Syria from our suburbs, and parents are very much worried about this, and there are committees in Sweden's suburbs to stop these young people from joining the ISIS, but it has become kind of fashion, kind of subculture among young people to go to these things. They think they can change the world and mean something by going into this. So we have 15, 16-year-old kids who go to Turkey and then to ISIS. So this is something that could have been stopped if the authorities were working with the Syrian government. But now, actually, at the same time, Sweden supports and the Western countries support the terrorists, they are actually sacrificing these young kids as cannon fodders.
And also, as there's now an outcry in the West against ISIS, it seems that the one force that's actually fighting them has been the Syrian army and the government of Assad, and yet there's been no willingness to coordinate, at least public willingness to coordinate actions with the Syrian government. What would you say from getting back to Sweden? I'm sure you've been giving your report to groups in Sweden. What's the response there? Are people buying into the anti-Assad sentiment still, or are people beginning to wake up a little bit?
Well, they are quite shocked about the reports about how there is a normal life there in Syria, and that there is a functioning government. And when I show the pictures of the city, very, very busy city, full of taxi cars and other cars, and school children going to the schools, there are traffic with school buses and all kinds of things. There are families walking on the Friday holiday day together in the streets. So it's a really a situation that people don't think they don't recognize from the media at all. So that's a very, very big shock to people here.
Well, you're listening to Ulf Sandmark from the LaRouche organization in Sweden, who's reporting on his recent trip to Syria. This is the LaRouche Show. It's November 22nd, 2014. And you can get, in this next issue of the Executive Intelligence Review, a written report with some pictures from Ulf, and who wrote the report on his return. Now, Ulf, you have an interesting report in, or a section of your report, on meeting with the Grand Mufti of Syria. And I'd like you to just tell our listeners a little bit about what he said, because clearly he pointed out that the destruction of churches and mosques are terrible, especially these monuments, but nothing compared to the life of a child. What was your impression from talking to this man who's a leader of Muslims in Syria?
Well, he was a really enlightened person, and he was a person making me think about Linden Helga, because he was really working and thinking and discussing on the highest level of epistemology and ecumenical cooperation among religions and the dialogue of civilization. So, and he drew from this region, actually, because they say there, or he said, that the Christians and the Muslims are very well together. The churches are standing beside the mosques in Damascus since hundreds of years. And there was a Muslim among our group who tried to joke with him, because they are quite friendly, and even though he was a very religious man, he was very open, and you could joke with him. So he our friend from Muslim friend, he said, these Christians, among them me, came to be converted to Islam. And that's why they came to Damascus. So then this Grand Mufti of Syria, who said immediately that that's totally unnecessary, because we Muslims are also Christians. And this is the mentality of the city since thousands of years, actually. I came to realize when I was there why it was from Damascus that Christianity reached out outside of the Jewish. Because you have this, I think it was St. Paul who said, neither Jew nor Greek. This is the policy in Damascus, that you are with all kinds of religions, all people are equal, and you are in dialogue. So it was natural for St. Paul to reach out to people who were not Jewish, and in this way Christianity started to be spread outside the Jewish groups into the whole world from Damascus. It's actually there he was converted, on this road of Damascus. So this was a great experience to see, because you could live this history there with the culture around you, with this thousands of years of history of religions working together.
And that's one of the things that's under attack by the barbarians of ISIS.
Yes, exactly. That's what also people said. They are attacking this kind of unity among the population. That's why they have this war, and also they're destroying the monuments to destroy the culture, just like the Talibans were doing in Afghanistan when they blew up these old Buddhist temples, and like the colonials did when they destroyed old civilizations in the colonies just to prove that they were superior culture to those who were conquered.
And it's your sense that there is still a thriving, protected Christian community, at least in areas where the Assad regime is in control?
Absolutely. The Christians are totally with Assad, and I mean, most of them, I mean, there are, of course, people in other areas under the control of rebels, but now we can see people who were with the rebels who are turning their weapons in and joining back into the under the government, because they see that the country is being destroyed. They see that the only defense actually for them against ISIS is the government. So we have more and more reports about hundreds and or 50 or 100, 200 rebels giving their weapons up. And this is a conscious policy of the government to try to reach out to these people. So they have started a special policy of reconciliation.
Now, one of the other striking parts of your report is your visit to the Ministry of Health and the report of what's being done to the healthcare system there. Of course, in the United States, we have our healthcare system being destroyed by Obamacare, but there it's actual physical assault. And I'd like you to give people some sense of what's being done, because actually, before these hospitals were attacked, the other part of the attack on the healthcare system was the sanctions policy, just as the U.S. sanctions against Iraq led to the deaths of large numbers of people due to lack of medication and immunization and things of that sort. So give us a little report of what's been done to the healthcare system in Syria.
Well, Syria had a very elaborate healthcare system. It also goes back to history because, you know, the Crusaders, they are called the Hospitallers, and you know they are the Red Cross. They are the Johanniters who are running the ambulances and the hospitals in Europe. They learned this from the Crusades. They brought the ideas of hospitals back home. So this is the area where you have old ideas of medicine, but also the medical service was rebuilt after colonization, so now they have a full medical service for free for all citizens before the war, and this was consciously destroyed and attacked by these terrorists. So they actually go into hospitals, cutting the throats of doctors, of nurses, of patients, and they destroy deliberately the hospitals. And many of these hospitals, the big hospitals, were destroyed. So the 60 to 70% of the big hospitals are damaged, and 30 of them were half of them were totally destroyed. So this is a conscious policy to destroy infrastructure, and in this way. So then, the industry was also quite advanced in Syria. They had a medical industry, and this was now dismantled and destroyed. So now they don't have any drug factories. So now when the embargo comes, they don't have the medicine. So this is hurting them very, very much now.
Well, Ulf, after listening to this, I assume that you came back with a certain sense of speaking on behalf of the people of Syria. What do you think the people you met with would like you to communicate to an audience in the United States?
Well, I mean, they told about this ISIS and the terrorists, that if this ISIS is not stopped, it will come back to the other parts of the world. It would go all over the world. So if we don't work together, they said, the terrorists will not be stopped anywhere. So we have to have a global effort to eradicate these terrorists, and then of course they are open to have support, open to allies, but they're fully confident, they're proud people, that they are going to win this war, that the government will be their government, they have the president, and that the country will prevail.
Now, you wrote toward the end of the article about the your bringing the reports on what happened with the BRICS countries and the New Silk Road, and you found a resonance there because Syria was part of the old Silk Road. Give us a little bit of a sense of that.
Well, this is the area where the whole world population has passed, because all of us came from Africa and walked this way, passing by the Middle East some 100,000 years ago. But then this has been the crossroads for the Silk Road. The Silk Road was indented partly by the people in there, and taming of the camel and things like that. So they have still Silk Road as a living culture. They have every year Silk Road festivals for the population, but for tourists also, where they dress up in the old costumes and styles and play out how it used to function. So the Silk Road is very much part of the mentality and ideas, and just as the ecumenical ideas, because this is also a question of culture, not just goods being transported by these caravans or camels coming from China and going to Europe and India and Iran and Africa and so on, Egypt and so on. So this country is very much living by this, and the government under Bashar Assad, the president himself has put forward a plan he called the Five Seas Plan, and this is very much in the ideas of the BRICS and the Silk Road to connect the five seas around Syria, which is the Mediterranean Sea, it's the Black Sea, it's the Caspian Sea, it's the Indian Ocean, it's the Red Sea. So in that way, if you connect those seas and the transport along over them with Syria, you will have Syria in the middle of the crossroads. So we hope very much that Syria will develop this idea and use this to organize the whole region for the Silk Road.
Well, of course, for history, as you point out, the Syria is in part of the world which was considered often the bridge between Eurasia and Africa. So it would make a lot of sense for that. There are also water projects, agricultural projects on the books, all of which could be realized through collaboration with the BRICS.
Yeah, in the last 30 years under this former president, the father Hafez Assad, and now the president Bashar Assad, there has been very big water projects, and the Assad Dam was built in the Tigris. So what you have in the Euphrates, and then you have the other dam in Tigris. So you had a very far away area, the corner of Syria, what's called the Hasaki province, where the population was some 300,000. Now it's 4 million, and it's it has a surplus production of grain and cotton, so they can actually feed the whole country. So they had a policy of development, and I could also see trees being planted some 30 years ago. Of course, they can't do it now, but there is an intention to plant the trees again on the mountains that had no trees at all.
Now, one final point on the situation that you encountered in Syria and the Middle East. There's the upcoming conclusion, hopefully successfully, of the P5+1 talks on Iran. There's a lot of squawking from people like McCain and others in the United States. Also from the Obama administration about Iranian involvement with Syria. But it also seems very clear that Iran is one of the only countries that's fighting against terrorists, that's fighting against the drug networks that are producing money to fund the terrorists. And of course, Iran is under attack not just by Israel, but also by Saudi Arabia. Did you get a chance to talk with people about Iran or have a sense of the relationship between Syria and Iran?
No, not really. I mean, the Iranians are very important allies, as also the Russians are, to supply them the Iranians are supplying them with some soldiers also, but also the Hezbollah in which is allied with Iran in Lebanon has been helping out very much to defeat the terrorists in the war. So the whole border to Lebanon has been cleared. So all this this has been very important to stabilize the situation in Lebanon, because then the terrorists is not going, can't go over the border that way. They have to go on other borders from Turkey, from Iraq, from Jordan. But so these allies have been very important. But they are of course looking to these possibilities of a broader solution to the crisis, and Iran is absolutely necessary to be brought into the peace process for the Middle East and for Syria and for Iraq. You have to have a policy to keep these countries together, and especially not to allow the division of Iraq into three different entities, because then you will have an endless war among them, and also with the neighbors about settling the borders, and also the minorities. You have heard about the Yazidis who have been eradicated in Iraq by ISIS. These kind of minorities will have no protection and will be very in a very dangerous situation if you don't keep Iraq together. And the same with Syria. You have to support the nation as a nation. And then you also need Egypt. So Egypt, who is Sunni, and Iran, who is Shia, they could put the pressure on the whole situation to stabilize those countries and support them.
Well, then you also
we have to bring in Russia, China, and together with the West to fight terrorism all over the world, because it's a global policy to spread this ISIS.
Well, and the support for ISIS comes from the British, from London, from the Obama administration, but also Turkey is playing a very rotten role, and we see it now with the Turkish forces standing on the border, not very far from Kobane, as ISIS was threatening the Kurds there. Now you have a fairly large Kurdish community, I believe, in Sweden. Has this led to any outcry and pressure on the Swedish government, the threatened genocide against the Kurds?
Well, there has been protests, of course, and a lot of media coverage about the Kobane. And what's happened now is we have a new situation, because before it was only about the Turkish Kurds or the Iraqi Kurds, but now everyone is unified among the Kurds to discuss also the Syrian Kurds. And therefore, I think we have an opportunity now to introduce Syria discussion into the Kurdish discussion. And in this way, have it put the pressure on all those countries where the Kurds are strong to help to support Syria and to stop the ISIS. You need to have a cooperation with Syria to stop the ISIS attacks against the Kurds. They will not be managing, and especially in this far-out province, Hasake, they are totally isolated, surrounded by Turkey and ISIS and Iraq, ISIS territories on that side. So the government can't really have any transport directly there. So it's a really difficult situation for that area. It's just that it's so big and has a lot of food and from itself that it can survive. But if not the Kurds help out to work with Syria, these Kurds in that province and the Christians there and others will be massacred. So we have a big chunk of Syria that can be is in danger if we don't support, if not the Kurds really mobilize to support and work together with Syria to stop this ISIS.
Well, let me again encourage our listeners to go to the website larouchepub.com to look at the next issue of the Executive Intelligence Review, which will have Ulf's article. And by the way, this issue, which is just out, has a beautiful picture on the cover of the five leaders of the BRICS nations, with the headline, China at APEC, the recently concluded summit in Beijing. West should join us on the new Silk Road. So I would encourage people, if you're not already a subscriber to the Executive Intelligence Review, Go online, you can subscribe online, or you can call your local LaRouche office and get signed up. Now, Ulf, let's just shift our attention for a moment to Europe and the continuing insanity from governments such as Merkel, Cameron, Hollande, and I don't know fully what the government of Sweden is up to, but you have this continued drumbeat of defending the Nazi coup in Kiev against Russia. And the Poroshenko government in Ukraine is doing what you just described in Syria. They're shelling hospitals, apartment complexes in eastern Ukraine. We just had this whole war scare in Sweden related to the submarine off the coast. What's the environment? Is there a kind of hysteria over Russia that's being built up by the media and the political parties in Sweden?
Yes, and I mean, there was a naive mentality that you could go on supporting all these wars in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and now in Ukraine without there would be any problems in the rest of the world. So it's like starting a world war, that you would be protected somehow here in the north. But now we have the tensions in the north also, in the Baltic Sea, and there is very much build up with the help of this submarine scare to try to force an anti-Russian policy. And this was very much connected. I think I have to switch my phone. I think it's the battery is going out. Hello, do you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
So the former government under Carl Bildt and the conservatives here, Carl Bildt was the foreign minister. They were very hostile to Russia, and Carl Bildt was actually the instigator from European Union, together with the Polish foreign minister Sikorski, who was responsible for organizing this coup from the European Union side in Ukraine. So he was out attacking Russia all the time. Now we got the new government in Sweden with the Social Democrats. So what came was a very big submarine scare, like a test for them to see if they would go the same way as Bildt. But they refused, actually. So they stayed. The foreign minister didn't say anything for the whole period of the submarine scare, and also afterwards, the prime minister and the defense minister refused to have any discussion about Sweden joining NATO. So they are standing firm in that way.
Has there not been a push to get Sweden to join NATO?
Yeah, that's a very strong push, and it's been organized with the help of these kind of scares. So what happened was that with the help of the change of the government, this is off the agenda now, and also in Finland there was a discussion, because in Sweden 60% of the population doesn't want to join NATO, and the same in Finland. So in that way, these countries are not going that way, but they are working very much closely in partnership with NATO, and has a lot of provocative military exercises with NATO in the Baltic Sea and in the Swedish territory.
Well, does the man on the street, so to speak, in Sweden actually think that the Russians are intending to reconquer Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and then move across the Baltic into Scandinavia?
Well, there is an old Russian scare in Sweden, and it's really stupid. It goes, and Swedes are afraid of Russia now because of this scare. You can talk to people in the streets, and they are. And unlike in Germany, they don't. Are not aware about the danger of world war, because we didn't have the war here. So they they are letting the politicians and the media, especially the media, is having hysterical anti-Russian campaign, and they are not really protesting that. They're letting it go. But in Germany, people are much more scared for world war, so they are actually understand you can't have this fight with Russia going on for long. You have to kind of calm down. And now we see also Eastern European countries like Hungary and Czechia starting to cooperate with Russia, like also.
They're now under attack by the same people who ran the coup in Ukraine. The National Endowment for Democracy is trying to whip up a colored revolution in Czechia and Hungary. Let me just ask you one other question on the Swedish situation, which is the relationship to the European Union and the euro. Clearly, this continues to be a huge problem for European countries. And
luckily, we did not join the euro, and that was part of our campaign in Sweden. We had a marginal effect, and that was part of this very small margin to stop the to win the referendum with a small margin. So in this way, Sweden is not in the euro, and that means that we have a more independent policy. And now they are introducing the zero interest rate here also. And in Sweden, it functions like a devaluation because we are a very small country. So then the money flows go out of the country and the currency is devalued. And then you get more possibilities for export and industrial production and jobs.
But that would be at the expense of your partners, your trading partners.
This is the way it functions now, because there is a zero sum now in Europe because there is no growth at all. There's no discussion about infrastructure. And even when there was the discussion about an infrastructure policy in the G20 meeting in Australia the other day, the Swedish radio couldn't really take it. They said this was a strange policy proposed by the G20 to have a policy for infrastructure development of 2% in 5 years. 2% is supposed in total for 5 years, very little actually. But they said this is something that cannot function with this different kind of economic system, both the communist in China and the liberal in the West. So they couldn't understand this thing, and they thought this was a kind of awkward policy to propose infrastructure development. So this is the type of mentality. It's also here very much into this monetarism and speculation.
But you're in with your party in Sweden, you're campaigning for collaboration with the BRICS nations. And how is that going? I mean, is there awareness of what the BRICS are doing?
Well, they try to play it down, and they say the BRICS is very weak countries. They have problems, and the BRICS will disintegrate. So they try to play it down. That's the way the media is doing. But then the industry is going around making deals, trying to go into these things. So it's always different with the media on the one side and the industry and the population that's really working with all these kind of export projects. Sweden is a very export-oriented country, and Germany too. I mean, they are looking for all these kind of projects all over the world. So in that way, we can push the BRICS very much with the help of into industry, into construction companies, into such companies that would naturally be involved in this infrastructure projects.
Is there much trade between businesses and industries in Sweden with Russia and China?
Well, a lot with China. We actually have Volvo cars was sold to China. So we have actually the biggest opportunity of cooperation with China because of this, one of the biggest biggest car industry we have in Sweden. Well, now when Saab is gone, it's the only one. We have also truck companies, but this car industry is Chinese owned and it's expanding a lot now. They're putting a lot of Chinese money into investments into expanding the factory here in Sweden, and technology and the development, the research and technology is being kept in Sweden, and this is the biggest chance we have actually of a real cooperation for big industry, but also with all kinds of small industry that go together with the car industry that can work with China. So, and then with Russia, we have a lot of industries there, but very, very few actually. There has been a policy from the oligarchy to keep Sweden out of Russia and out of this economic operation. So that's what we work with to try to change. We want to build the tunnel to Finland from Sweden, from Stockholm to Finland, and another one in the north, and have a what is called the European 10 project. It's a Nordic triangle to have a full high-speed railway and highway between Copenhagen, Oslo in Norway, and then Stockholm, and then Helsinki, and then St. Petersburg and Moscow. So we would have a connection, a very rapid connection and good transport. So these kind of projects are part of a kind of Roosevelt New Deal policy for Sweden that we are pushing everywhere in the world. It was actually the same policy we pushed in Syria to organize the Syrians to use the Roosevelt policies. And they
well, all of this goes back to the initiatives of Lyndon and Helga Zepp LaRouche and to our organization, which is the one organization which is fighting to promote in the West an alliance with the BRICS rather than what Obama and Cameron and others are doing, which is to prepare for war with especially Russia and China.
Yeah,
well,
yeah,
Ulf, we're just about out of time. You have anything last thoughts you want to add?
No, I mean, this Syrian experience is, of course, something I have very much on my mind now, and I think this is absolutely necessary that we stop this destruction of the oldest civilization we have, both with the people keeping it up as a population in Syria, and also the monuments that are being consciously being destroyed just now, and it's being protected by the Syrian people, the Syrian soldiers, watching them in the deserts, in the heat, and they're trying to protect this heritage, and we should really work with them.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. This has been most interesting hour. I, again, would encourage people to go to the Executive Intelligence Review and get Ulf's article, as well as the continuing coverage of the fight between the BRICS and the collapsing transatlantic system. So, Ulf, thank you for joining us today.
Okay, it was a great pleasure.
And this will end the LaRouche Show for November 22nd, 2014. Remember, this is the anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and we are the ones bringing back the Roosevelt-Kennedy tradition to the United States. So stick with us, join us, and support LaRouche Pack. And join us next Saturday at 3 p.m. for the next edition of The LaRouche Show. Goodbye.